this doctor was here, Dr. Would I like to go? Mm-hmm. And I said, yes, sir, indeed. And I jumped out of bed, got myself clothed, and gathered enough things together. And then, at that time, the girl who was giving the anesthetics was with us, and so she went too. And we went down to our nurse's office. And she had breakfast there ready for us. And he had a beautiful Fiat ambulance car that we drove in all the way to the front.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And where was this?
This was at Etretat on the Channel, mm-hmm. English Channel.
Right.
And
right.
We drove up. And on the way, we stopped and got ourselves tin hats out of a great, they call them dumps. And this great pile of tin hats, and I found a French
helmets, were they helmets?
A helmet,
mm-hmm.
a
mm-hmm.
French helmet mm-hmm. that fitted my head. And the other nurse found one too. And then we drove on again, and all the people were coming down from this big city that we were headed for called Amiens.
Mm-hmm.
And they were walking in the gutters, and the highway had in and out, you know, and just crowded with ambulances and all kinds of vehicles.
Well, what were your responsibilities, and how much training did you have?
Well, I was a regular registered nurse,
mm-hmm.
operating room nurse, and that's what I was going to do when we got up to the front.
Mm-hmm.
You see,
mm-hmm.
When we got there, I went on duty right away and had a table in this large room that had a building that was recently completed by the French for an insane asylum. So all the doors locked when you got out of them, so we had to have a brick.
Mm-hmm.
So Miss Keller and I had a room, and there was great activity in and out. We were 5 miles behind the front.
Mm-hmm.
And every night the German warplanes were flying over and bombing Paris.
Mm-hmm.
And they we'd see 18 fly over every night.
Mm-hmm.
And we worked on one of these operating tables on the wounded that were coming right from the front to the first station that they got to was our place.
Mm-hmm.
And they were given the first treatment there. It was day and night service.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And
did you get much sleep?
Not much. And when we had a chance to sleep, and we had to put the brick in our door, somebody might get in and shut the door, and we couldn't get out
mm-hmm.
because it was this modern building, great big beautiful place that had just recently been completed for the insane
mm-hmm.
and mentally ill people. And it was right outside of the city of Amiens, 7 miles.
Mm-hmm.
So in the meanwhile, there was a mix-up, and we shouldn't ever have been there, because already we had a unit at the front,
mm-hmm.
but I wasn't with that. And when this doctor came down from the front and asked for a team, we went, but with no authority to do it, you see. So they were looking for us over,
mm-hmm.
and finally located this where we were, and we were told to return to our base.
Mm-hmm.
So
did you work mostly with men then?
What?
Or did you work mostly with men or with women?
Well, when I was at the front, with
mm-hmm.
yes, that was I worked that man, that doctor who came and got us.
Mm-hmm.
We were the team,
mm-hmm.
and I worked with him all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I went back to our, we had to drive up to Paris and then go down to Etretat.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got back to Etretat, I was in charge of a ward of 130 patients.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then I was transferred from that ward to those were sort of convalescents.
Mm-hmm.
And not many bed patients, but we changed every 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And very active.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was transferred from that ward to an operating room surgical ward.
Mm-hmm.
And then came the awful flu epidemic. And I don't know if you've ever heard how they died like flies. The men on the steamers going over died like flies. That flu epidemic in 1918 was throughout our whole country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I recall, just barely.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
did that affect you at all? Were there inoculations?
Why, of course.
Mm-hmm.
We would have a funeral every afternoon, and 4 and 5 ambulances, 4 boys dead, and each ambulance taken up to the little local cemetery, and there a service was held, and we would have to go as escort, you know. And
to escort the ambulance?
The ambulance, they would have a little service in the local cemetery, and then have the bugle play taps, and the French people came and joined us in the service, and we had he wasn't a priest, but he was a pastor.
A chaplain. Mm-hmm.
And he would conduct the service. That was a harrowing experience.
Mm-hmm. Was that the most frightening experience for you?
What?
Was that the most frightening experience for you?
Oh, no. When I was right there at the front, it was mm-hmm. frightening mm-hmm. because they were bombing over our heads all the time.
Mm-hmm. Well, what were you thinking during all that time?
I didn't have time to think, but I'd do my job.
Right.
And work.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, how did the men respond to you as a woman in the service, as a nurse?
Oh, no trouble. The men, I call men.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And no trouble at all. No, but I know that other units did have troubles because the nurses were not organized at that time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we had no rank when I was in the Army.
Mm-hmm.
No rank. And in Washington, a book about that thick called the Army Manual. And in only one place in that big Army Manual were the nurses even mentioned, and they mentioned nurses and pet dogs and that sort.
In the same category.
Yeah, yes. And then when the war was over and we came back, the nurses on the Atlantic Coast, thousands of us, went to Washington, and we went through Congress, the House and the Senate, like a hive of bees. They were reorganizing the Army Manual. And we said to those congressmen, the nurses want rank.
Mm-hmm.
We have to have rank in order to control conditions in the wards.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like drawing teeth. They didn't want them to do anything for women in those days.
Mm-hmm.
And we gave us what they call relative rank.
Mm-hmm. Which was?
Which was relative rank. It wasn't equal.
Mm-hmm.
When World War II came along, we went to Washington again. All the nurses organized on the Atlantic coast went into Washington again and said, see here now, we want equal rank for nurses in the Army. We are in charge of the wards, not these corps men, and not sergeants or any. The nurses are in charge. Then we got it from Congress, so then we got equal rank. And when the nurses came into the Army in World War II, they were lieutenants and so forth, and rose up, and now we have people in Washington, D.C., a general.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know her name. She's a new one.
Mm.
But the nurses in the Army now, everywhere in Army and Navy hospitals, all have rank.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that occurred after World War II then? That occurred after World War II?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
It was
mm-hmm.
in World War II that we got equal rank.
Mm-hmm.
And
what did you enjoy most about your work?
Oh, that's a hard one. I liked the work that I was doing because I felt I was useful and needed.
Mm-hmm.
And I liked doing it.
Mm-hmm. What exactly was that?
What was the
most significant part of that for you? Was it talking with the soldiers,
oh,
with
no,
the GIs?
Oh, no, it was Army with regular nursing.
Mm-hmm.
I was in charge of a ward.
Mm-hmm.
And then that experience of being at the surgical table when I was up at the front.
Mm-hmm.
And that was all meant a great deal to me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What did you like least?
What? Oh, I can't tell you what I like least.
Why not?
Well, I don't know anything that I took. I'm not that kind of a person to take likes and dislikes.
Really?
No.
You just feel you have to do what you have to do. Is that
yes.
correct?
Yes. I had a duty to do, and I was regimented and had to do as I was told.
Mm-hmm.
But at that time, we were so thankful that we could do something and be of use,
mm-hmm.
that it wasn't a personal thing at all.
Mm-hmm.
Look at all the things I got for my birthday. These are from my birthday yesterday.
Yes, I heard. Happy
98.
Birthday.
This and that one up there.
Excellent. They're beautiful.
And all these white flowers.
They're beautiful.
Yes.
It's you must be commended for what you've done. I mean,
I don't know. I'm a very modest person. I don't go around blowing my horn or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
But people have been very kind to me. Is this all going on tape? Oh, gosh.
Well, since you mentioned regimentation, that's my next question. How did you adapt to regimentation? Was there difficulty adapting at
no.
all? No.
No.
No?
No. We were working hard for our country.
Mm-hmm.
I forgot about myself. I didn't worry. I wanted to do my job.
Mm-hmm. So that was most important to you,
oh,
to
yes.
do your job?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Were you ever married?
No.
No? May I ask why? I know that's personal, but may I ask why?
I'll tell you a story. I had a family that were, and this Irishman was president of one of the banks in New York, and he liked an awful tease. And he used to tease me, and he would say, "Miss by choice, I hope." I was Miss by choice. Yes.
So it was your choice then?
It was my choice,
mm-hmm.
yes.
Was it because of your dedication to the
no,
service?
No, not necessarily. Well, I just didn't want to get married, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see
those
yourself?
Personal questions they shouldn't ask anyway.
Well, I'm concerned about...
Who? Can we turn this off for a minute? The Presbyterian Hospital Unit of New York City, in which I was a nurse overseas, sailed on the 14th of May, 1917, and we were in France on the 30th of May, and at that time, no provision had been made by the U.S. Army to feed the nurses. Fortunately, our commanding officer had taken along $8,000, which had been given him for any emergency that would arise in the welfare of the nurses. Immediately, our commanding officer, who was a colonel, surgeon, Dr. Brewer, he saw to it that we would have something to eat, but for 3 days we lived on British rations that were left over from the British nursing corps that had moved out from this hospital, and we had tea and
crumpets,
canned salmon, and bread.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And our commanding officer then immediately began spending the money to get food for us. And eventually, the Army did take on the responsibility of feeding the nurses.
That's incredible, isn't it?
Do you like that for the story?
Yes, very good. Thank you.
Yes.
How do you think the being in the service as a nurse, how did that affect your self-image? How did you see yourself when you were over there?
I was glad that I had something to contribute for my country.
Mm-hmm. That's excellent. I know you mentioned to me earlier that you were on the front line. So you were on the front line. You mentioned that to me earlier.
Well, right behind the front line.
Right behind the front line. So I'm sure you were in a life or death situation. But have you ever considered, could you ever kill for your country?
Ever.
Could you ever kill for your country in a life or death situation? Could you ever do that?
Why, of course not.
No?
I wouldn't be called upon to do anything like that. Mm-hmm. I don't understand that question.
Well,
who
there
made
are some
these
women,
questions up?
Well, there are some women who are in that situation where they could and can go into combat. And I know throughout history a lot of those women have been ignored. But there can be a situation where you have to fight for your own life. And I was just concerned that since you did serve, perhaps if you were to join today, that you could possibly kill for your country. And it's just a question, just a philosophical question, more or less. And I was just curious whether you could or not.
Too old. 98.
Well, do you think you could when you served
during
the First World War?
If anything happened, for instance, if we had an earthquake here and I could help, regardless, I would help if I was able.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Of course.
Okay. I know that you have just numerous stories about your experiences overseas. And can you give us some examples or anecdotes of some of the funny things that happened to you while you were there?
I know I can't think of them right now. Well, I have to have a preamble. In 1917, activities on the front were held up for the American Army to get over there and fight. But we had still many convalescents, and on my ward I had 137 or 8 beds. And many of those patients were ambulatory, and wore the convalescent hospital uniform of blue canton flannel pants and white canton flannel jackets. And the Aussies and the Jocks, the Scotch boys, they were pretty lively young men. And the priest that we had would take them for long walks. And they never came back empty-handed. They would steal the chickens right off of the farms, wring their necks, put them under their coats. And when they came back from these walks of 15 to 20 miles, they always had something for me. So then we'd have to see about getting those chickens plucked and cooked for them.
Oh, that's really very good.
That's
All while the priest was walking with them, right?
Yes, and the priest, he couldn't control it. And then eventually, those priests were superseded by men who understood men, and they got men who had been in this country selling tobacco and cigarettes. And they understood better the young men who were in the army. Mm-hmm. And so that the discipline was better when they went on their walks. But apples, they'd bring back anything they could steal from these farms. They don't call them ranches and they don't call them farms. I guess they'd call them farms. And
did you keep a diary while you were there?
No, we all had 12-hour duty. And we'd go on at 7 o'clock in the morning and come off at 7 o'clock in the evening. Mm-hmm. And if we had a moment, we could go back to our quarters at 5 o'clock in the afternoon and have a cup of tea. And then go back to the ward and serve the meals and put the patients to bed. But that was when I was at base hospital number 2.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that was 12-hour duty every day of the week, Sundays included.
Mm-hmm.
And
what did you do in your free time? Any free time that you had?
Maybe walk around the little town, make friends with the local French people,
mm-hmm.
and they would give me beautiful bouquets of flowers for my room out of their gardens, and we would take them things to eat. They were short rationed, the local people. If we had anything that we could spare, we would sneak it down and take it to them. Sometimes we would go to the French church for Sunday meal, Sunday service.
Mm-hmm.
If we had any time off, we might ride into in an ambulance, the city of Le Havre, 20 miles away, and see some Americans there, and they would spoil us by giving us a big dinner to eat.
Oh, really?
And
did religion play an important part in your life?
What?
Did religion play an important part in your life?
Religion?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I've always pretended to be a good church woman.
Was that Catholic or Protestant?
I'm Episcopalian.
Episcopalian.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And is there something?
Well, do you have a philosophy of life then? Do you have a worldview? How do you see yourself and your purpose?
In the worldview?
Mm-hmm. How do you see yourself and your purpose?
I'm a very patriotic person,
mm-hmm.
and I'm a Republican,
mm-hmm.
and since I've retired, I've become very conversant with activities in Washington, D.C., and have through magazines, but now I can't read them anymore, or I have to use a magnifying glass for reading,
mm-hmm.
and I read big print
mm-hmm.
books,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
but I had to give up U.S. News and World Report, and two other Republican magazines or papers, you might call them,
mm-hmm.
and can't remember the name of them. But I kept the U.S. News and World Report.
Mm-hmm.
And
do you have a philosophy of life, though? How do you see your role in the world, or your purpose in the world? How do you see your role or purpose in the world? Do you have a philosophy of life?
Is it on tape? I think as I've gotten older, I've become more tolerant of people. Not so critical,
mm-hmm.
and more inclined to forgive.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. If you were to pick a time in your life that was really significant throughout your entire life, a period of time that was most significant to you, that perhaps changed, was a turning point for you, or changed your view of yourself or the world, what time would that be? The last 10 years, the last 20 years, the last 40 years?
Well, after seeing the misery and hardship that was everywhere around us during World War I, overseas experience, I never wanted to see our country in a war again.
Mm-hmm.
And when World War II came along, I tried to get in some branch of service. I ran up against the statement, oh yes, we'll take you, but not just yet. One of these anyway, I didn't have a chance to do anything till all of a sudden I went up to Inverness, where my mother and sister were living, and my sister said to me, Mr. Logan, an Englishman who lived there in Inverness, has had a letter from a nephew he has never seen, who is a POW and of the Germans, and is in a camp in Germany. And I said, I'm going right over to see it. I went over and saw the letter, and I said to Mr. Logan, let me have that. I was on duty at that time in a public health job that was from 3 o'clock until 11 o'clock at night. And I came back to the city and went right to the Red Cross the next morning before I went to work. And I said, here's this letter I have. What can I do to help? And the Red Cross woman said, we have parcels of food already made up that can be sent to the POWs in Germany or anywhere. And I said, can I make them up myself? I got this. And she said yes. The Red Cross said yes and gave me the directions, 2 pages. And I went home and read them, went out, and I bought enough to fill 4 boxes, and they went for free. And in each box I put something significant, like a fountain pen, or a picture, or a little book, a story. And I wrote a letter to this young man named Moon, who was a POW, and it went to the Red Cross in Switzerland. And he got the boxes, and in my letter to him I said, what did you find in your box that you couldn't eat? Write and tell me. So all those 4 boxes were divided with his friends, And I got word from them, they got the pen and they got the little storybook. Then I knew for sure that they had gotten the boxes of food,
right,
which was what happened.
Exactly.
So then through the Red Cross in newspaper articles and the papers, the Examiner, the Chronicle right here, they wrote up the story of what I was doing, and people began calling me up, I want to help, how can I help, and I had it all typed out for them, how they could pack boxes and how to send them and tie them four ways on four sides. One of the requisitions of the government, special box, special size and all. And
you just thought of that on your own?
Yes. And I kept it up for 2 years. And I went to work all the time.
That's incredible.
And I had all that correspondence with the... They had a magazine called POWs. It was published in Scotland. One of these POWs wrote home to Scotland and told about an English woman, an American woman was sending us parcels of food in the camp.
Mm-hmm.
And that was written up in the POW magazine. And that magazine was the only piece of that I knew about,
mm-hmm,
that went to the prisoners of war in Germany. And so the English people began writing to me, I have a son in this camp, I have a son in the other camp, can you send them any food? They're hungry.
Mm.
So I got people to help me.
Wonderful.
And I had people from the Atlantic to the Pacific on my lists sending food, and we did it for 2 years, and then American Red Cross and Army took it up in a big way. And they would send carloads with the boxes already fixed. And I got word from Washington, D.C., stop. You're not permitted to do this anymore. And I wrote to everybody, congressmen that I knew.
Did they give you a reason?
And I wrote to Mrs. Roosevelt, Anna Roosevelt, isn't that her name?
Mm-hmm. Eleanor, right.
Eleanor.
Did they give you any reason?
Yes, the reason was that the government was doing it in a big way, and
mm-hmm,
they were just taking over my work. So and Mrs. Roosevelt wrote back, the letter that she wrote back to me is up in the Eisenhower Museum with all that stuff, all the records that I kept and all the letters that I had from the POWs and from the families in Great Britain and in this country, people right around Alameda, down the peninsula, wrote to me, how can I send something to my son or my brother or my son? And I would tell them that my contact all stopped because of the... And that was right, in a way, because they superseded and did it in a big way,
mm-hmm,
and sent the food. Then, 6 months later, I had a letter from the Board of Economic Warfare in Washington, D.C. If you still have your lists of the POWs that you send food to, you may be permitted to send them books. And if you send any books, you have to do it under our direction. Okay. They had to be tied the same way. And books of a...
Where did you get the list of POWs, and how did you get the food to Germany?
I think I told you about... going to Inverness one day and getting the list of a POW from his uncle, who was a neighbor of ours. And then I give you the story of going to the Red Cross? I went right to the Red Cross that night. At that time, I was working. In a large factory, evening hours. So I had time in the day to do things. And I was working from 3 in the afternoon until 11 at night over in Oakland. I'd drive there from San Francisco. And then the rest of the day I could devote to all this work that I certainly got into getting parcels promised to me through the Red Cross to go to Germany.
And where did those parcels go to?
Hmm?
When you addressed them, where did those parcels go?
I went, when I came, heard from, got the letter and went to the Red Cross in San Francisco on my way home that morning. And they told me that they had parcels already prepared to go for $2.40 a piece. And I said, well, could I send parcels myself? They said, yes. And we will give you the directions. So I went back and I bought enough stuff and filled 4 boxes. And I sent the 4 boxes over. I wrote to this boy, Humphrey Moon, and sent him 4 boxes, and in each box was something significant. I had, from that time on, after I sent the first 4 boxes, the story was written in a Scotch magazine that was allowed in the camps called POWs. There was a little story about an English woman living in California named Elsie Phillips, who was sending them parcels of food. And the little article thanked me for doing it. Those little magazines went into the camps, the only literature that was allowed by the Germans in the POW camps. And with that, I had a flood of letters asking, please send me some food.
Mm-hmm.
That I received these letters from the POWs that were only allowed 2 postal cards and 2 letters, form letters, a month for them to write home.
Mm-hmm.
They were very precious to them, but they would spend one of those, send me a postal card, asking if I could see that they got some food.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you made plenty of friends while you were overseas.
Yes, I did, and I kept in touch with them, but they're all gone now but me, myself. I'm the last member of my unit that went to France.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And all the people that I took my training with to be a nurse have passed away. I've lived too long.
No, no. You don't look a day over 75.
Well,
so what does that feel like to you?
I feel very grateful.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I can't do much anymore.
But you have glorious memories.
But, well, I... of course I have the memories. I came from a big family, 4 sisters and 2 brothers.
Mm-hmm.
All grew up to die in their 80s and 90s.
Mm-hmm. So anyone living?
No, they're all gone.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother lived to be 95. My father was a graduate of Columbia University
New
York City, and was an attorney and an athlete. There he is there. And he died at 40 years of age because of a heart condition that they didn't know how to take care of in those days.
Mm-hmm.
He would have lived longer if they'd known what they know now.
Mm-hmm.
But he left my mother with seven children. She had eight children. She lost one, Eileen.
Mm-hmm.
And we all lived useful lives,
mm-hmm.
but all are gone now.
Mm-hmm.
Now the last one.
You mentioned after the war, after the First World War, that you worked in a factory. Where was that?
Oh, and after the First World War, I went to Wyoming, and I was on a dude ranch and a boys' boarding school for 11 years.
What were you doing?
I was a nurse,
mm-hmm.
and it was a school for boys in the winter time, and a dude ranch for guests in the summertime, and I was the assistant manager, and then we were 40 miles from a town, and I took care of sick people on the river. I'd ride horseback down or up, whichever way they would call on me, and we were at the end of the telephone line, 40 miles, 2 miles from town, the town of Cody, Wyoming, and doctors down there. So we were on a branch line. And whenever they'd hear the ringing, and we were on the end, and our call was two shorts and four long. And whenever the other people on the line would hear that all click, and they'd all listen to what was going on at the dude ranch. And I would hear them answering.
Mm-hmm.
So
this was a resort then during the summer? Is that what it was, a resort during the summer? The ranch.
Was it what?
Resort during the summer.
What's that word?
A resort.
Dude people,
mm-hmm.
the dude ranch,
mm-hmm.
in the summertime,
mm-hmm.
and we would have, yes, and we had cottages all through the woods, and near the river, beautiful grove, and it was very expensive for these people. Most of the people came from outside of Chicago or New York City in the suburbs of Boston. And my boss was are you taking this down? My boss was a Princeton man, and he would go back east and visit two or three cities and line up dudes for the summer,
mm-hmm.
and boys who had been kicked out of some good schools in the East were our first school boys, and they each had their own horse, and we had four masters to teach them,
mm-hmm.
and College Board examinations were given for them in the spring, and everything was going along well, and then came the crash. What year was that?
29?
Yes,
mm-hmm.
big crash of 29.
Mm-hmm.
Our big project was overextended financially. Absolutely. I think it's been misunderstood in places and badly handled, but in the long run, it'll come and get straightened out.
Mm-hmm.
Don't you think?
I agree. Did you experience any discrimination when you were serving? No?
No.
No?
We had with us, when I was in France, we had medical students from the College of Physicians and Surgeons in New York City. They volunteered immediately, and so our corps men were mostly intelligent,
professionals, right?
Doctors, young men training to be doctors,
mm-hmm.
wanting to and had volunteered to help in any capacity to get overseas and work, and they did the core work. We had a young man named Draper. His brother was on our unit as a doctor, but he was just a core man, and he had a beautiful tenor voice, and he would sing for any parties that we had, he would sing. And one thing that was funny that happened, he and two or three other boys were on this ward, not my ward, but on another ward in the casino that of the town that had been turned into a hospital. And they made up a story themselves and called it the Bedpan Parade. And they came on in the afternoon and they put on a show. And they carried the canvas cover for the bedpan on their arms and the bedpans on their hands, and got up on the stage in the casino and put on a show for the sick patients in the beds.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I didn't see it, but I heard about it because I was not in that ward. But it was hilarious. And all of those were highly trained, intelligent men preparing to be doctors at the medical school in New York City, but had gotten on the unit as volunteers to do anything and did anything.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that's a funny story for you. And do you like that story?
Yes. I have another question, which is somewhat unrelated. I'm just interested in any social restrictions you had. Did you have social restrictions as a nurse while you were overseas?
Social
restrictions? Yeah.
Oh, yes, I was in the Army, and we had to conform to all Army rules.
Mm-hmm.
We had to be in at 10 o'clock at night. And over there, I don't know if you know, they have these long twilights, lasting 9 and 10 o'clock at night. And so, we weren't allowed out after 9 o'clock. The doors were locked. So that we accepted all of those Army regulations and rules because we were doing the type of work which we wanted to do, and that was to help the people and the our own soldiers who were wounded in the war.
Mm-hmm.